Good afternoon. Welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. I do hope you're very well. This is part of Faith Explored every Saturday, the part of Premier's programming that helps thinking Christians to think through their faith, and indeed on Unbelievable invites non-Christians as well to join the conversation. And whether you're listening this Saturday afternoon or via the podcast or internet, it's great to have you along. We are going to be updating what's called our podcast feed, our RSS feed, to give it its technical term, on the website soon. So if you listen via podcast or iTunes and so on, do make sure to refresh that. We had one or two issues when we tried to do it last week, and that's interrupted some people's podcast feeds, some people saying they can't seem to find the latest edition on their iTunes. You should be able to find it if you subscribe to the iTunes account, but it hasn't for some reason updated properly the iTunes store, the preview, if you like, of what's available. So do go and subscribe if you can on iTunes. And that should correct that. But thank you, however you're listening. It's great to have you with me. And today on the programme, we're going to be talking about a hot-button issue, abortion. I'm going to be introducing my guests in just a moment's time. We'll be hearing some of your feedback later on in the programme as well. Had lots of your feedback to last week's programme, which was a history of atheism, really, with Julian Bergini and Nick Spencer. Later on today, you can hear a profile interview that I took recently with Jonathan Vieira, the singer, songwriter and very funny man. He's going to be my guest between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And don't forget that all of the items you hear on Faith Explored every Saturday are brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. I'm the editor of that. And if you want to subscribe, you can find out more about it at premierchristianity.com. You can get a free sample copy as well, and you'll find lots of interesting articles turning up in the magazines related to Unbelievable. Indeed, if you're a regular listener, you may remember when I was joined by Guillaume Bignon, the French atheist turned theologian. Well, he features in the latest edition, the October edition of the magazine. So look out for that and do request a free copy if you'd like to at premierchristianity.com. Okay, well, we've got lots coming up in today's programme. I'm really looking forward to our discussion. It is, of course, one of those issues which obviously touches people on an emotional level. And so if at any point you would like to speak to someone in confidence, then I can recommend Premier Lifeline. That's the helpline of Premier Christian Radio. And you can reach that on 08456 52 52 52. That's all I have to say for an introduction. Why don't we meet today's guests here on the show that aims to get you thinking?
You're unbelievable.
Well, during the summer, Richard Dawkins' statements about Down syndrome and abortion on Twitter started a new conversation on the whole issue of abortion. And we're going to be addressing that a little bit in today's programme. But really, it raises the whole question of the abortion debate, which comes around in one form or another quite often, something we've certainly talked about on this show a number of times before. Well, two guests join me on today's discussion as we ask, abortion a woman's choice or a baby's life? Mara Clark is here from the Abortion Support Network. Scott Klusendorf is the president of Life Training Institute, and we're going to be hearing from them both, a little of their background, but getting pretty soon down to the big question of where the right stand when it comes to abortion. Mara, let me just introduce you as someone who may not be familiar to many listeners. You're American by background.
Yes, but in England for 9 years now.
Yeah, so you must feel like one of us already.
Oh, you've
point.
No idea. I take out the Zs and I put in the Us.
That's very good. It is a bit of a bugbear of mine, the Z thing in very many American spellings. But you've made your life here, obviously, for the last 9 years.
Yep. I have a British-born child.
Wonderful. Okay. And what kind of particularly, I know you do a number of different things, you've got a number of hats you wear, but when it comes to the Abortion Support Network, what made you begin that particular part of your work?
I used to do similar work volunteering with an organization in New York that helped women forced to travel to New York City to get later term abortions or second trimester abortions, as we used to say. And when I moved here, first of all, it was astounding to me to live in a country where abortion is free and available on the National Health Service. Well, actually, the fact that there's a National Health Service was in and of itself an amazing thing. And that birth control is free on the NHS and labor and delivery is free on the NHS. So that was great. So I looked to see if there was any sort of similar organization that I could get involved with, one that directly helped women accessing abortions. And that's when somebody said, well, look at Ireland and Northern Ireland, where abortion is against the law in almost every circumstance.
Mm.
Pretty much unless you can prove that the pregnancy will make you imminently die, you can't get one. And so the only option for those women is to raise 400 to 2,000 pounds and travel to England and pay privately for a termination. And so we sort of had a look around to see, well, if the Department of Health is saying that 5,000 women a year are traveling over, that means there's got to be 500 or 50 or even 5 who aren't traveling over because they don't have the money. So that's the
So that was the genesis of the thing. And obviously, from that perspective, the services you offer, the advocacy is directed at those who have more difficulty than those who are resident in the in English shores, as it were, for We'll come, obviously, to some of the big issues that surround this, obviously. But as far as you're concerned, this is a faith debate program normally.
Yeah.
And this issue comes up a lot. Do you tend to find that this issue tends to split down faith lines very often?
Absolutely not.
No?
No. I'm a person of faith. The entire time I've been doing this sort of work, which is 12 years now, off and on, in two countries, I know Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Jehovah's, Baptists, you name it.
Mm.
And I've seen them on both sides of the issue.
So you wouldn't see this as something that is a Christian, non-Christian issue in that sense. It's very much you find diversity of opinion, I guess, in both camps.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It's going to be really interesting to hear your perspective on this.
My first time on a Christian radio station.
Well,
I'm kind of excited.
There is a first time for everything. It's our first time welcoming Scott Klusendorf onto the show as well. Scott, thank you for being with us by Skype. Do you want to just give us a little bit of your background as well, Scott, and how you got into the area of work you're known for now?
Well, my undergraduate degree was English literature at UCLA, where I read a lot of philosophy, and that kind of sparked my interest. And then my graduate degree is Christian apologetics, which, of course, furthered my interest in philosophy. But I think the thing that changed everything for me, Justin, was in 1990, I went to a pro-life presentation, and I had always been pro-life philosophically, but I wasn't doing much on the issue. If you looked at my behavior and you looked at my proclamations, they didn't really add up. I was not behaving as if I believed abortion was the intentional killing of an innocent human being. And I went to a presentation where a lawyer, a former politician from Pennsylvania and a former member of the Reagan administration laid out a very persuasive case for the pro-life view. And I thought, man, this guy doesn't hurt the brain to listen to. He's intelligent, he's sharp, and not all pro-lifers I had heard up to that point were that way, but this guy was. But the thing that changed everything for me was he showed images of abortion. And when I saw abortion, I had never seen abortion, Justin, but when I saw it, I was floored by what I was dealing with. As I was looking at the dismembered remains of a human fetus, I thought to myself, man, my rhetoric does not match what my behavior is. And to make a long story short, within 6 months, I had resigned my job and had begun studying how to train pro-lifers, how to make a case for the pro-life view persuasively and yet graciously. And from there, I began going across the country and indeed the world training pro-lifers to do just that. And as I was looking over the videos that Mara has on YouTube, I thought that there was a point at which we do agree. She made the point that if we outlaw abortion, poor women will not have the same access to it as rich women do. And I thought to myself, you know what? She's right. We shouldn't outlaw abortion. In fact, we should trust women to make all of their own personal decisions if the unborn are not human. And I came to the conclusion that the decisive factor in this debate hinges not on choice, not on trusting women, not on financial equality, but what is the unborn? We have to address that question first.
And again, would you echo her sentiments that this isn't necessarily a Christian versus non-Christian or a religious issue in that sense?
Yeah, Mara's absolutely correct about this, and I appreciate her pointing that out. Look, there are pro-choice Christians who cite the Bible to defend abortion rights, and there are pro-life atheists who cite science and philosophy to make their case. It cuts across all religious syndromes. So it's not like it's only a religious versus non-religious view, and she was correct to point that out.
Well, let's get into some of the meat of this discussion. We've termed this as a sort of something of a dichotomy in our question, abortion, a woman's choice or a baby's life. And I think probably it makes sense for both of you to sort of represent the case on either side, just going into this, just a few minutes each. So, Scott, I wonder if you would start by making the case for abortion being ultimately about a baby's life being at stake. Do you want to just kick off on that, and then we'll have Mara respond with her side of the...
Sure, I think it does help to bring clarity to what the issue is about. Well, I agree with Mara when she makes the point that restricting abortion does not stop it, and that if we do restrict it, it just means that rich women can get access to abortion, but poor women can't. And she's right about that, if the unborn aren't human. I agree, it's totally unfair for poor women not to have access to abortion. But not if we're talking about the taking of a human life. And, of course, I think that's what abortion is. The central case I would lay out, Justin, is that the science of embryology establishes that each of us from the very beginning was a distinct, living, whole human being. And that's not a religious viewpoint. That's something the science of embryology clearly establishes. Philosophically, I would argue that there's no essential difference between Mara, the adult human, and Mara, the embryo, that would justify killing her at that earlier stage. Sure, she was smaller as an embryo, but size is not a good reason for saying you could be killed then but not now. I don't think level of development is a good reason for saying embryos have no rights. Development continues long after birth, and it would follow those who are more developed have a greater right to life than those with less. I don't think our location matters either. In the womb, outside of the womb, we remain the same being. There's doctors, for example, that perform surgery on fetuses where they partially remove the child, do the surgery, put the child back. Does it follow the child goes from being non-human to human, back to non-human? And then finally, our degree of dependency. Sure, we depend on the mother for survival, but dependency on another human being does not mean we can kill you. So that would be the basic argument that I would lay out.
And so from that perspective, as far as you're concerned, if there's any question that what we're dealing with here may be from conception a human, we should exercise a great deal of caution in the way we treat that.
Yeah. To use a common example from President Ronald Reagan, if you're out hunting and you see bushes rustling in front of you and you don't know if it's that deer you've been after or your best buddy, are you going to open fire? Well, not unless you're Dick Cheney. I mean, you're going to err on the side of caution. There's no way you're going to open fire when what's in question is unknown.
Okay. Mara, okay, let's give you the chance now to state your case and give your perspective on this. And very important, I think, that we do have a female's perspective on this as well, which was very much part of the reason I wanted you to be with us today. You can either respond to what Scott had to say or simply outline, as it were, as far as you see it, the case for a woman's choice.
Okay. I mean, first of all, I want to say that I'm not a professional debater. Unlike Scott, I don't have PhDs and years of experience in all this. And I'm also not a scientist or a medical professional. What I am an expert in is what happens when women, and it's not just women, sometimes it's women in couples and families and everything, what happens when they have unplanned pregnancies. And I'm not going to debate about where life begins, because a lot of the women who contact us for help believe with all of their hearts they're killing a baby and they're going to burn in hell. And they're still having an abortion because, well, for a lot of different reasons, because they already have three children and they can't afford another, or they discovered that the baby has catastrophic fatal fetal anomalies, or for whatever reason, they have looked at their lives and determined, I cannot parent this child, or in most cases, another child, because the majority of women who have terminations or abortions already have at least one child. And if we're going to talk about right and wrong, I mean, I'm a parent. I know you're a parent. I'm going to assume Scott's a parent. You know, I don't understand why that's not the moral decision, is to say, I can't take care of this child. So I'm not going to have this child. And, you know, I'm not going to say, okay, at 6 weeks, 1 day, or at 24 weeks, 3 days, or this is when it's a baby, and before that it's a fetus. You know, no woman ever got pregnant and said, oh my God, I'm going to have a fetus, you know.
But do you believe, I mean, I'd just be interested to know from your perspective, do you basically cohere with what are currently the British guidelines about the so-called, you know, cut-off period for when a pregnancy can be terminated or not?
Oh, that sticky wicket, the time limit. Yes, the Mail and the Telegraph have both had a lot to say about that in the last couple
recently,
of weeks.
Yeah.
The thing is, again, it's a two completely different debates. Okay, the fact that some babies born at 23 weeks survive and some babies at 23 weeks, 5 days are terminated is the difference between a wanted pregnancy and an unwanted pregnancy. It's, you know, science can do all sorts of things. And again, for me, it's forced pregnancy is not okay.
I suppose what I'm trying to establish from you is, do you believe then, if it's simply about whether someone can support a child or whatever that makes the case for abortion, could that happen right up to term as far as you're concerned?
Oh, that's, I mean, again, I just have to go back to my practical experience of dealing with women. Okay, so in the United Kingdom, minus Northern Ireland, fewer than 1.4% of all terminations take place between 20 and 24 weeks.
It is very rare.
Very, very rare. And the top reasons for those are very young girls who didn't know they were pregnant, older women who thought they were getting menopause, women in or escaping abusive relationships, and wanted pregnancies that become unwanted. But there's another reason why women have terminations later, and that's the women that we see who are living in Ireland and Northern Ireland, and they're coming over later in pregnancy because they're trying to raise the money. So for me, practically, all a time limit is going to do, again, is further infringe upon the most disenfranchised. So I, you know, again, like, look, I had a baby, I've seen the scan, all that sort of stuff. I'm not going to make the argument that I know people would love to jump on, which is that it's not a baby at that point. I'm not going to make that argument.
Okay. We're going to be opening this up. If you've got something you'd like to say and you'd like to respond to today's program, be welcome. We welcome your emails as well, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, you can send me your thoughts via our Facebook and social media accounts on Twitter, @UnbelievableJB, if you want to follow that way, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. You can even comment under today's show on the webpage. That's at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're asking today, abortion, a woman's choice or a baby's life? And on the programme today, Mara Clark of the Abortion Support Network is in conversation with Scott Klussendorf, who's the president of Life Training Institute. Scott, for Mara, then, it is simply a very practical issue about people's livelihoods, their ability to cope with children, and that sort of thing. What's your response to that?
Well, my first response is to just point out something here, that Mara said she did not wish to engage on the question of what is the unborn and argue it that way, but she did assume a status about the unborn, and let me just point out a few things about that. She said that there were parents who can't afford to take care of another child or don't feel responsible at that moment to do so. Notice that assumes the unborn is not already one of us. No parent would say, hey, I'm going to kill my two-year-old because I can't take care of him right now. The only candidates that are put forward for killing for that reason are fetuses, which is assuming that the fetus is not one of us. But that's the key issue we need to resolve. Are the unborn one of us? As I said in the opening, I agree completely that abortion should be legal for any reason the woman wants if the unborn are not human beings. She mentioned wanted children. The homeless are unwanted, but that doesn't mean we can kill them. So once again, that objection assumes the unborn aren't human. And this is a classic case of begging the question, where you assume what you're trying to prove. And even her case about poor women not being able to afford abortions like rich women can assumes the unborn aren't human. We certainly wouldn't argue that we ought to make it legal for the poor to hire hitmen to kill people they like on grounds that there's economic inequality. We only do that with the fetus because we're assuming it's not human. But that's the question we need to resolve, Justin. Look, I'm vigorously pro-choice on women choosing their own husbands, choosing their own religion, choosing their own doctors, their own boyfriends, their own worldviews. But some choices are wrong, like intentionally killing innocent human beings simply because they're in the way of something we want. And that's the issue we have to get
sure.
to. I know that Mara doesn't want to discuss that, but the problem is if we don't discuss the question, what is the unborn, we're either A, acting in negligence by killing something that might be a human being, or B, we're begging the question by assuming they're not already human.
Okay.
And all I'm saying is Mara could be right, but she needs to argue for it. She needs to make the case.
Scott's going to sort of force you a bit to address this issue, because he says at the end of the day, everything you do depends on that question of whether the unborn child is a human or not. And we can't apply, I guess, a different standard if it is an unborn child we're talking about to a child who has been born. I mean, do you see those as two different cases, the two-year-old compared to the fetus in the womb?
I do, yeah.
You do? And what's the reasoning for that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I really have to say again, I'm at a disadvantage. I haven't memorized everything Scott's ever said
sure.
that's been filmed, so I can't quote his arguments back to him. I mean, at the end of the day, no, do I think that something that is in a womb, that is unable to survive on its own outside of a woman's body, is equal, you know, is deserving of equal rights and privileges to
the woman's choice.
To me,
yeah.
basically,
sure,
right?
Sure.
And this is the issue in Ireland with the Eighth Amendment that basically says those two things are equal. Again, I'm not a legal debater. The thing is that I also think that it's absolutely fine for Scott to think, okay, that's a human being, and you're murdering a human being, but not everybody believes the same way as he does. And so that's sort of where I'm gonna have my biggest sticking point, which is that obviously there are many, many people in the world who do not agree with him, and so those people should have the rights to make those choices. And also, I've again spoken to many women who do agree with him, who do think that a fetus in the womb or a baby in the womb is exactly the same as a living, breathing,
but are
walking,
still prepared
talking
to
child,
terminate it.
But are still prepared to terminate. And that
would they? I mean, but they presumably would never be prepared. You would never counsel them to do that to a child outside the womb. Obviously.
I don't counsel anybody.
But, no, sure,
but
sure.
Yes,
but
no. I would not. I would not advocate for people killing their toddlers, no matter how annoying their toddlers can be sometimes.
I mean, I suppose that kind of is perhaps a measure of the desperation that some women find themselves in, that they would do things that they even themselves would say feel is immoral at some level in that case. But is it just a case of a choice between two bad options, and we kind of choose one over the other in that sense?
Well, again, I can only speak for what I would do if I were in that circumstance. Do you know what I mean? I can't make broad proclamations that cover everybody's moral choices. I just know that from my experience, you know, when a woman is pregnant and doesn't want to be pregnant and is told me that she has drunk bleach to try and stop the pregnancy, and this is in 2014 in the developed world, right? That to me, the option between this woman potentially dying and leaving her existing children motherless and never having any more children in future.
So that somewhat trumps for you the whole sort of these slightly more technical questions of when life begins and so on, if you're dealing with someone who's drinking bleach and attempting to end their pregnancy that way.
Yeah, and also, again, it's the fact that parenthood to me should not be a punishment. And if you're going to say, right, all life from conception is human and deserving of full rights and privileges, then we need to go back a step and talk about sex. So if we're going to say, then basically we have to take it a step back and say, right, either we are going to outlaw non-procreative sex, or we have to accept that sometimes there will be unintended consequences of non-procreative sex, which is unwanted pregnancy.
Right. We're just pushing up against our first break here, so we'll let Scott come back to that as soon as we come back in a moment's time. But you're listening to a discussion on abortion today. It's entered the news again recently over the summer, Richard Dawkins' statements about Down syndrome and abortion, and perhaps we'll get to talking about that as well in the course of today's programme. But the question we're asking is abortion, a woman's choice or a baby's life? Mara Clark of the Abortion Support Network joins me here in studio. Scott Klusendorf is on the line. He's from the Life Training Institute, and we'll hear his response to Mara in just a moment's time as we unpack some of these big issues. It's a big, big ethical issue, not something that necessarily is a purely Christian, non-Christian view. As we've been saying early on in the program, different people take different approaches on this, but be interested to hear your thoughts on it too. So come back in a moment's time for more here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we assess the impact of what's been called the Christian Holocaust in Iraq, including a special interview with the Vicar of Baghdad, Canon Andrew White. I'm gay, but I'm still an evangelical. We speak to former worship leader Vicky Beeching about coming out. And popular preacher J. John gives a masterclass in how to make your sermons sparkle. All that, plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists in the October edition.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Briley, and we're talking about abortion on Unbelievable today. Part of Faith Explored, helping you to think through faith every Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio. But certainly a subject which raises a lot of emotional issues as well as the philosophical ones that we're dealing with on today's programme. It's a big social and political issue as well, of course, in many ways. And I'll be interested to hear from you. We'll be reading out some of your responses to the last few weeks of programming later on in today's programme. But if you'd like your thoughts read out on a future edition of Unbelievable, why not email them in? That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or follow me on Twitter or Facebook, and you can do it that way, and I'll try to include as many as I can. Always do get a lot of calls when we cover the subject of abortion, and two different points of view here in the studio today. Mara Clark of the Abortion Support Network and Scott Klusendorf of Life Training Institute, both joining me to talk about their different perspectives on this. I said we'd come back to you, Scott, and again, Mara outlining just some of the situations that women find themselves in. Were you surprised? I have to guess that I was a bit surprised to hear Mara talking about even women who will say, yeah, I actually do think I'm killing a child in doing this, but they'll still go ahead because of the situation they're in just makes them feel that is the only option. Is that something you've come across, Scott?
Yeah, I hear that. It's interesting, though, they never kill their toddlers for those reasons. They would only consider killing their fetuses. And it was interesting what Mara said. I had laid out a case from science that the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. And I laid out a case from philosophy that differences of size and development and location are not good reasons for saying you could be killed then but not now. And I did find Mara's response a little bit interesting. She said, well, not everyone agrees with that case. But that's not really a response, Justin. Look, people once disagreed on whether slavery ought to be right or wrong, but it didn't mean there wasn't a right answer. They once disagreed on whether women should have the right to vote. It didn't mean there wasn't a right answer. And if absence of agreement means a position isn't true, then her own position is falsified because many people disagree with her pro-choice view. She did answer this, though, and I'm glad you raised the question when you said, why are they not the same, meaning the toddler and the fetus, in terms of their status? They're certainly different, but in terms of their human status. She did mention location. She said the fetus basically is in one location. It's in the womb. The two-year-old is out. But again, she needs to argue why location matters. Why is that, decisive?
Can I come back to you on that, Mara? You said it was an issue of I think the way you put it was could a fetus survive outside the womb? You know, it's dependent at some level on the
woman. She mentioned that as well, yes.
Yeah, so that's kind of the location thing, I suppose.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to let Scott frame my debate for me.
Sure.
I appreciate that he wants to talk about the things the way he likes to talk about them. But I guess what I want to know is, if we're going to stop all abortion and make abortions not happen, what are we going to do with those women who are pregnant who don't want to have their babies? Shall we jail them?
Yeah. No, fair question, Mara, and I'm prepared to answer it. I just want to make it clear that I did lay out a case, and I gave reasons for my case, and I didn't just say this is my personal opinion. I actually think my case is correct, and I could be wrong. I'm very open-minded. And if you have good reasons to show that the unborn aren't human, I want to be clear that I agree with you. That was the point I began with. This is not a debate between those who are pro-choice and anti-choice. We're both anti-choice on a whole lot of things, spousal abuse, polluting the nation's rivers, all kinds of things. And we're pro-choice on other things. But on this issue, the fundamental thing that divides us is not choice versus anti-choice, but what is the unborn. And my simple contention here is, and I'm not framing your debate, I'm making a case here. The simple thing we've got to resolve that we can't escape is what is the unborn. Because if we simply assume the unborn aren't human and talk about choice, who decides, trusting women, illegal abortion, we assume the unborn aren't human, and I can't in good faith let that assumption go unchallenged.
I mean, okay, if you were to frame this debate, what are the terms of the debate? I mean, the problem is we're at a kind of fundamental impasse here, almost, in this show, where Scott says you can't talk about this debate until you've settled this question of the child in the womb.
You can have as many philosophical, scientific debates as you like. And I've already said that I'm not expert in any of that. I'm an expert in real women's lives. Hmm. Okay? So what I'm saying is it doesn't matter.
Well, the question is which women, including those in the womb or only those outside?
I mean, you
Well, there you go. Yes, only those outside. Only
okay,
those so. who are housing the fetuses. And that, by the way, is a scientific term, fetus. It's not one that I made up.
Well, it means young one, but it doesn't mean it's a different species. But, okay, fair enough. So it's the only ones that count are those outside of the womb. That
and I didn't
position.
Say that either.
Okay, I'm asking, is that what you would say?
No, what I'm saying...
I misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
What I'm saying is that all I can base my argument on is my experience of the circumstances that people who can breathe on their own and walk on their own, and I can hear already the argument that you come up with, you know, people who are in comas or whatever, and should we just shoot all of them? And no, I'm not advocating that either. At the end of the day, all I can go with is women who are living outside of the womb absolutely have a right to, and I don't say this term, I never say this term, bodily autonomy, right? Mm-hmm. They have a right to continue with or not continue with a pregnancy.
Okay, so that in a sense overrides any issues of whether we're dealing with a human in the womb or not. For you,
yes,
the autonomy of a woman over her body trumps that. And that presumably is the distinction then that we're drawing between the toddler and the child in the womb. A toddler, separate to the woman at that point, obviously, there's not a question of her having control of her body at that point. You're dealing with a separate individual. But you'd say that...
Yeah, we can send the toddler to Scott's house and Scott can raise it.
Okay. So maybe this helps to give some clarity for you, Scott, on mm-hmm. where the pushback would come from Mara in terms of you know.
Yeah. I'm glad that we're now doing the philosophy we can't avoid doing. I appreciate that Mara doesn't want to go there, but we can't avoid it. We have to do these metaphysical questions. There's no getting around it. So what about bodily autonomy? Well, that's an interesting concept. Here's the issue I have. If a woman has bodily autonomy, in this case, we can't limit it. So let's say, for example, a woman is suffering from intractable nausea from morning sickness, and she goes to her physician and says, I'd like to have thalidomide to reduce the symptoms. And the physician says, no, it will cause your child to be born without arms. Suppose the mother goes to a location, gets the drug anyway, and takes it, and then 4 months later gives birth to a kid with no arms. Do we think she did something wrong? If she has bodily autonomy, she has a right to do whatever she wants with that pregnancy, and no one should second-guess her, including taking drugs that could be harmful to the fetus. And it's interesting, Justin, that here in the States, Mara, I'll let you speak to how it is in England, you would know better, but here in the States, even to take a drug like Accutane for acne requires that women of childbearing age who are sexually active provide proof of two forms of contraception before they can take the drug. And the reason is simply that it will harm the fetus. It's of no harm to the mother, but it is to the fetus. And the question becomes, if the mother has bodily autonomy, why does she need to verify this? It's her body, her choice.
Well, in America, they also arrest pregnant women for smoking cigarettes and taking illegal drugs, which I don't agree with taking illegal drugs while you're pregnant, but I also don't agree with putting somebody in jail for doing so. Here in the UK, there's some interesting things. One of the things that I find very, very interesting is that it is legal in this country to have a save your sibling, which means to purposely genetically engineer a second child in order to basically use it for parts.
Yes.
And that is legal here, which has not happened
in America as yet.
I don't know.
I don't know what the law is on the states. Are you approaching anything like that in the state, Scott?
No, not yet. But Mara, I'm wondering if I could just ask you a question, and it's not meant to be a trap. I'm just curious what you think. You said you weren't in favor of women taking drugs while they're pregnant.
Illegal drugs.
Why is that?
Well, I'm not really in favor of anybody taking illegal drugs, which I know is going to get me phone calls.
Why? You mentioned specifically a pregnant woman. I just was curious, what's wrong with a pregnant woman taking drugs, even drugs that may harm her fetus, if the fetus is not a human being?
See, but here we go back to my argument, which is it's not about viable versus not viable, human versus not human. It's wanted versus not wanted. So, you know,
if that's true, you don't have a problem with taking the drugs. It's the woman's choice, and that's just the way it is.
I mean, this is the question of bodily autonomy. If a woman has the autonomy to kill the fetus in the womb, what's the difference between that and taking something that will cause a deformity once the baby is delivered in that sense?
See, this is when I wish I'd taken that ethics class in uni. Because then somebody could write down all my answers for me, I could study them and then come onto the radio and just say them. I can only speak for myself and my own experience. Mm. And I think we're sort of getting off topic. Like, you know, there are people who think that you shouldn't drink at all during pregnancy, but if you go to France, it's okay to drink. And actually here in this country, it's okay to drink. Mm. Or in America, they'll literally scream at you in a Starbucks if you're visibly pregnant and order a coffee. Whereas here, I think the NHS says 4 cups a day is okay. Right. So, you know, these are very different shades of kind of a separate debate to a woman who wants to continue a pregnancy and a woman who doesn't want to continue a pregnancy.
I mean, obviously, your point, I suppose, in all this, Scott, is that there's an inconsistency here, as far as you're concerned, between the state at one level allowing a woman to kill the fetus in the womb, but at the same time having laws and restrictions on doing anything that might potentially harm the development
ongoing healthy development of a fetus in the womb, and that those two are somehow fundamentally in contradiction.
Well, here in the States, a woman can get an abortion for reasons that are, as Planned Parenthood's own literature points out, socioeconomic through all 9 months of pregnancy. Now, here's the interesting thing. A woman could be driving to the abortion clinic to have an abortion, and if en route she has an accident, an automobile accident, with the doctor who a few moments later will kill her unborn child, that doctor in many states here will be prosecuted with homicide, at a minimum vehicular homicide. And yet, if the mother were to arrive at the clinic safely and he were to abort her child a short time later, he would have no penalty at all. And I find that crazy. That's absurd. I think the pro-life view has a better way of framing this. And we simply argue that each and every human being, regardless of age, size, development, gender, has an equal right to life. We're human equality advocates.
Okay, so Scott thinks that from the moment of conception, it is a human in the womb, that is entitled to equal rights and privileges to any other human in the world, and I don't. I just don't. And so we're not. You are correct. Not going to get around that. And we can go log our heads.
And you're not prepared to kind of put any kind of a marker in the development process that we should say at this point, this fetus does become a child, you know, a baby, a human in that sense.
I mean, in England, I mean, it's interesting that Scott says that in America you can have a baby, you can have an in America you can have a baby at any point at 9 months. No, he said that in America you can have a termination at any point in the 9 months. That's actually not true at all. Most states have gestational limits that are quite a bit lower than 9 months. Here, the legal limit, we call it 24 weeks. It's actually 23 weeks, 5 days. Okay. That is in most circumstances. There's also something we're not talking about, and it's a whole other moral.
Well, the disability, which you can obviously apply for a termination.
Fatal fetal anomalies, we prefer to say, because you say disability and you think of, you know, babies aborted because of cleft palate. But the couples I've dealt with, we're talking about anencephaly and Edwards syndrome and in Pompe disease.
Well, I mean, this
Justin,
does...
Justin, real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was said that I was wrong about abortion being legal here. That was a factual statement I need to address. Let me just be very quick about why Mara is not correct on this. In Roe v. Wade, in its companion case, Doe v. Bolton, the Supreme Court of the United States said that states may only restrict abortion in the third trimester if and only if those restrictions do not interfere with, quote, the mother's health, unquote. In Doe v. Bolton, the court went on to define health so broadly you can drive a Mack truck through it. Health means psychological feelings, economic feelings, family issues, you name it, it counts. In fact, the Supreme Court specifically cited the United Nations definition of health, which is well-being. So from that, we get a situation where a state can only restrict abortion if it doesn't interfere with that woman's health. And that's true even in the third trimester. And with health defined so broadly, it amounts to virtually no restrictions at all on the procedure, which is precisely what a U.S. Senate subcommittee determined in 1983 when it looked at this issue.
And where are these clinics where women can get these terminations?
Let me name two. There's Warren Hearn's clinic in Boulder, Colorado. He wrote the book Abortion Practice, the medical teaching text that teaches doctors
This. I guess my point is you are right about the law, but in terms of accessibility, last time I checked, either 87% or 89% of U.S. counties didn't have a termination. Didn't have a provider.
Mara, you're kind of changing the subject. You challenged me on the legal question. I answered the legal question, and you jumped to the practical one.
You said there are gestational limits that are in place.
Yes, she did.
Yeah, okay.
So in
Pennsylvania, for instance, please tell me where you can get a termination after 16 weeks.
Let's say you couldn't get one. By the way, you can open the phone book in virtually every state and find abortions in the second trimester without any trouble at all.
It's not
Yellow Pages search will do that for you.
Not true.
So that's simply not true at all. You mentioned late-term clinics. I was in the process of
naming two.
Some of
There's
them.
Three, actually, but okay.
Mm. That's still three that make it legal to do so, and the question was legality.
Okay. Well,
Not the same thing as saying that any woman in any part of America
there is an
at
issue
any
of
point
availability.
In her pregnancy can skip into a clinic and have a termination at 39 weeks.
Okay. You mentioned Pennsylvania. There's the Gosnell Clinic that operated and did late-term abortions, in fact, killed born children as well. So there's your Pennsylvania example. You got Warren Hearn's clinic in Colorado that is there. You got the famous one.
We'll leave that issue aside for the moment, because I think we're kind of drifting into slightly more specific and technical issues regarding the availability of specific abortions. But we were, I think, getting towards an area that I wanted to address at least briefly, which is this issue of the story that kind of, brought this whole issue to the fore again over the summer. Richard Dawkins made certain statements on Twitter about Down syndrome, effectively saying that it would be immoral, on his view, to bring a child with Down syndrome into the world if a woman had the knowledge in advance about it and so on. Now, he clarified that in a blog post and so on. You can't say everything you want to say in 140 characters on Twitter, but it did raise this whole issue of is there at some level a kind of a discrimination in the womb against, people with learning disabilities or anything of that kind? Is there a sort of a eugenics of sort going on, at some level? Because the fact is, I think that most people who do take a test during pregnancy that monitors for Down syndrome do end up aborting, terminating that pregnancy. You're shaking your head, so I might not have that right, Mara. But most who take the test and it then shows positive as having Down syndrome.
I'd be interested in seeing numbers.
Okay,
on that.
I don't know if you're aware, Scott, of what the stats look like on that front when it comes to the showing up signs of disabilities of one kind or another in the womb.
Sometimes the tests are mistaken. Sometimes they're accurate. Even with our modern medical technology, we aren't always able to learn what's exactly going on in the womb. But I think Richard Dawkins raised an interesting question when he said, we shouldn't be bringing into the world children with Down syndrome. Notice again that he assumes there's not already a child in the world. He assumes the unborn aren't human. He hasn't made an argument for it. He, for a guy who prides himself on science, he just ignores the question of what is the unborn scientifically. He simply assumes it's not one of us by saying we shouldn't bring that kind of child into the world. Even more disturbing to me, though, Justin, is what it means here. He is making the argument that is very elitist. Those who are perfect, according to his view, have rights, and those who don't meet his subjective arbitrary standard don't. And I think, again, the pro-life side has a great way of accounting for human equality, because we argue that every human being, regardless of location, size, or development, or dependency, has an equal right to life. We can account for human equality because we don't ground human equality on what we can do functionally. We ground it on what we are by nature. Each of us, you, me, Mara, have the same human nature, and we had that human nature from the moment we began to exist. That's the true basis for human equality. And where did each of us begin to exist? Well, again, the science of embryology is clear.
Okay.
That
Throw this over to Mara. I mean, what did you make of that whole thing that blew up in the summer?
I think Richard Dawkins is an idiot.
Okay, so didn't agree with him on that one.
I give him the same credence as I give Bernie Smith, who says that women who are pregnant, who are suicidal, should be restrained and force-fed until they come to term. Which reminds me that that Scott never answered the question of what we do with women who want to have terminations. Do we put them in jail or restrain them or force-feed them and force them to have the babies? And I'm also interested in the fact that that he was saying that in America the abortion law is wide enough to drive a Mack truck through. That's a big lorry for you people in England.
An articulated lorry.
Yes, an articulated lorry. That he was saying that, little things like family circumstances and socioeconomics are nothing when it comes to people.
I didn't say nothing. Well, I said those were the reasons.
Yes,
that were
and you were, but you
health.
Were you were dismissive of those reasons.
I think you may be putting words in my mouth, but go ahead.
Wide enough to drive a Mack truck through. So whereas for me, I don't think that those are insignificant things. I think that when women and couples are deciding whether or not to have a baby, and again, we are going to disagree about, you know, to birth a live human,
sure.
as opposed to an in utero human.
And within
human.
That,
yeah.
do you agree with the right of a woman to choose to abort a child if it has Down syndrome, for instance? Is that something that you may not be what you would choose or you would never advise anyone to, but if it's their choice, you would support a woman wanting to do that?
And again, as Scott says, we allow women to have terminations for all sorts of reasons. Mm. And my my younger brother is... I cannot keep up with the terminology. Mm. Developmentally delayed, okay. I think, is what it's called mm-hmm. now. And, of course, I love my brother very much. Mm. But, you know, again, the cases of divorce when there are children with special needs are through the roof. Mm-hmm. Services are being cut left and right for, well, children full stop, you know, daycare, healthcare, everything else. At the end of the day, if somebody looks at themselves and says,
I couldn't cope.
I mm-hmm. couldn't parent that mm-hmm. child. Mm-hmm. I couldn't give that child a good life. Then to me, yes, absolutely. Women need to be able to make those decisions for themselves rather than parenthood being forced upon them as some sort of punishment.
Right. I mean, again, it's coming down from our on the practical issue of how will can we make this work practically? Do you feel again that the issue of in the case of a disability or a learning disability that a woman should if it counts as human, then we need to apply the same standard we apply to someone who has a learning disability outside the womb, Scott?
Well, again, notice that these objections assume the unborn aren't human. We would not kill toddlers for these reasons. We only kill the unborn for these reasons. So once again, the assumption is there that the unborn aren't human, and I'm simply arguing you can't just assume it. You've got to make a case arguing they're not human. You can't just make that assumption.
What is your solution then?
Question.
Go ahead. On the basis that you do believe every life, disabled or not, mm-hmm. is a human life from conception, what would be your alternative for the woman who comes to Mara and says, I'm not going to be able to cope with a pregnancy?
Yeah, no, fair question. First of all, this is why I love the work and the efforts of crisis pregnancy centers that use their own funding and now outnumber abortion clinics in the United States over 2-1, where they will provide support, help, financial support, clothing, prenatal care, postnatal care to these women who come. They give them a place to go. And I know this because I serve on the board and speak at banquets for these centers yearly. In fact, I help them raise over $1 million a year. That's about half of what I do, focusing on helping women in this situation. So I do agree with Mara. We need to reach out to these women. We need to have something for them. But again, even on the suicide issue, she mentioned drinking chlorine bleach, for example. We would not say to a mother who had a 2-year-old, listen, you're suicidal and you're telling us that unless you have the right to kill your 2-year-old, you're going to take your own life. We wouldn't say to her, go ahead and kill your 2-year-old. We only say that about the fetus, again, because we're assuming the fetus isn't human. And that's the question we just can't get around.
We come back to again. We're going to take a quick break and then just a couple of final statements from you both for what's been a really interesting discussion today on Unbelievable. Talking about abortion. Always provokes a lot of questions, and perhaps you've got something you'd like to say in response. I'll make sure to give you the ways to get in touch as well in a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable, part of Faith Explored, every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. Welcome back to the third part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, part of Faith Explored every Saturday, brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you want a free sample copy, premierchristianity.com, and go there to find out all the interviews, features and related material. Lots of interesting stuff on there if you are into theology and apologetics and that kind of thing. Okay, still to come, your feedback. And it's been interesting to see your response to last week's programme, which was a really fruitful, I think, discussion between Julian Baggini, atheist philosopher and writer, and Nick Spencer of Theos on his book, Atheists, the Origin of the Species. Also, after we've finished up our discussion on abortion, and before we hear some of your feedback, I'm going to be chatting to Carl Fass. He's the man behind a new DVD called Towards Belief. It's being launched here in the UK. He's from Australia, but he'll be telling us about why he's been around the world talking to leading thinkers. We're also looking forward later on this afternoon to an interview with Jonathan Vieira. He's my guest on The Profile between 4 and 5. He's a fabulously talented singer, songwriter, actually recorded this interview with him at my local church here in the UK, and you'll be able to hear some of his singing and so on that as well. So that's to look out for between 4 and 5 this afternoon. Next week on Unbelievable, we're going to be looking at Pascal's wager. Yes, hundreds of years ago, Christian mathematician and philosopher Blaise Pascal made a wager. He said that you'd be better off believing in God, because if there is an afterlife, well, you win, and if there's not, you've nothing to lose. Whereas if you don't believe, then you've everything to lose if it turns out that there is a God. Well, what do you make of that? Kevin Moore is a young philosopher who's actually updated this argument. He's got a very interesting take on it. So next week, we're going to be introducing you to Kevin and his particular way of phrasing Pascal's wager. And we'll be asking, is atheism a fool's bet? So we'll obviously have an atheist as well to interact with Kevin on that. But look out for that at the same time next week. OK, time to get back into our discussion today on abortion. And just again, if this is an issue that affects you on a personal or emotional level and you'd like to talk to someone in confidence, you can, of course, talk to someone through Premier Lifeline. That's 08456 52 52 52. Look forward to receiving your commentary as well, of course, on today's programme, and we'll be giving out the ways to get in touch again in a moment's time. So let's finish up our discussion today on abortion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding our discussion today on abortion, a woman's choice or a baby's life, we've tackled this really with two people who are just coming from fundamentally different perspectives as to what the deciding issue is on this. We've had time and again Scott Klussendorf saying, we really need to work out, are we dealing with a human here? And that will define the rest of the debate for us, because it will say what we do can and can't do with that individual. For you, Mara, you're adamant throughout this that it's really about the circumstances a woman finds herself in, whatever the debate may be around the humanity or not of the child. In the end, it's a practical issue. Women will be, I guess in the end, if they can't find an abortion legally, women will still have abortions, and they'll just be very unsafe and potentially put the woman's own life at risk. So for you, this issue, it sort of trumps to some extent all the arguments around the humanity of the child. Is that the case?
Interesting, you call it a child.
Well, that I suppose is again one of those things where we have to define, well, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of raises emotive questions.
No, again, I mean, I appreciate that it's frustrating to have somebody on the show that won't actually engage in the terms of the debate that you've set out. But what I'm saying is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether or not we say a baby in the womb or a fetus in the womb is a full blown human life. What matters to me is what will happen if you take the right to terminate away from women. And what does happen, what we've seen happen, is women do really, really desperate and dangerous things. They get pills off the internet. Some of them are safe, some of them aren't. They throw themselves down flights of stairs. They drink bleach. They use chopsticks. It's not pretty. And and this includes women who absolutely do believe that they are killing a child and that they're going to burn eternally in hell. And they're still doing this. And I agree that, you know, that for the women who don't feel they're actually making a choice, that they're doing this out of desperation, I absolutely agree that we should, that more services should be made available to them. And I haven't raised $1 million for crisis pregnancy centers, but every bit of kit that my small one outgrew went to a crisis pregnancy center. So I play both sides of the fence as well.
Sure.
I'm pro-choice on women who want to have their children and bring them to term. But if a woman doesn't want to have the baby, she's not going to have the baby.
And she shouldn't be forced to.
She shouldn't be forced to.
Okay. Scott, just a final thought from you and we'll wrap things up.
Sure. Thank you, Mara, for supporting pregnancy centers. That's kind of you. And I do share with you a mourning over any woman who dies from an abortion. Any woman who dies from an illegal abortion is a tragedy, and you and I share that concern. But notice again, when we argue that we need to keep abortion legal because women will die if they get illegal abortions, we're assuming the unborn are not human. Because unless you begin with the assumption that the unborn aren't human, you're basically saying that because some people will die attempting to kill others, the state should make it safe and legal for them to do it. But why should the law be faulted for making it more risky for one person to intentionally kill another innocent human being? That doesn't make any sense to me. In fact, Marianne Warren, who's a pro-choice philosopher, made the point very well. She said that some people may indeed be harmed having illegal abortions, but that doesn't justify making abortion legal because murder is wrong regardless of the consequences of prohibiting it. And then we can also point out that it's simply not true that women are forced to get illegal abortions. They choose to have them. I mean, saying that they're forced is kind of like saying that a man who the state won't put on welfare is forced to go rob a bank. No, he has other options. And then finally, I would point out it's simply not the case that either in the UK or in the US, women were dying by the thousands from illegal abortion prior to legalization. In the UK, Malcolm Potts, who was the architect of the law in 1967 that liberalized abortion in the UK, he says in his book flat out that people on his side of the issue often exaggerate these death numbers to try to make a political point. Here in the US, we know that that same thing happened. Bernard Nathanson made that point. He was one of the founders of NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League. And even Planned Parenthood's own statistician, Christopher Teets, called the claim of thousands of deaths annually from illegal abortion, quote, unmitigated nonsense, unquote. I think we ought to be outraged at all abortions, Justin, not propose one kind legal over another illegal. I think we ought to protect all humans and grant all humans an equal right to life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much both for being with me. Much more that could have been said, but time is against us, so we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both for contributing today. And if you're interested in getting in touch, we'd like to hear from you as well. But for the moment, thank you, Mara, for being with us on the program. If you want to find out more about the Abortion Support Network, it's abortionsupport.org.uk. And thank you, Scott, from Life Training Institute. That's prolifetraining.com if you want to find out more. In the meantime, we shall, I'm sure, pick this up again at some point down the line.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback shortly to last week's show. It was on the history of atheism and generated quite a lot of response. Nick Spencer and Julian Bagini joined me for that one. So we'll be hearing what you had to say about that in a short moment's time. But another man who's been responding to atheism and indeed all kinds of worldviews in a recent DVD is Carl Fass. And he joins me on the line now. Carl, thank you for joining me.
Good to be chatting with you, Justin. Thank you.
You're an Australian, and I think you're involved in church leadership over in Australia. But for the last couple of years, you've been involved in quite a major project, bringing together lots of speakers and ideas onto one DVD, which aims to answer, or at least attempt to answer, some of the big questions and criticisms of Christianity. It's called Towards Belief. What made you embark on this massive project, Carl?
Oh, Justin, well, we've been involved in media, as you suggested, for a little while, and we've done a couple of different series. But I was actually listening to Richard Dawkins on an Australian television show when he comes to Australia. A number of our channels are very keen to have him on. And it was just not that he just that he's an atheist or that he disagrees with the worldview that I would hold to, but just so dismissive and a very kind of dismissively arrogant position. I was moved and angered by the whole thing, especially in the idea there must be a way to respond to this that's helpful for everybody. And most of the time in thinking about apologetics, it's always really kind of highbrow, hard to listen to. And we wanted to produce something that the average person could listen to.
And the average person being someone who maybe is reasonably intelligent but doesn't necessarily have like a vast background in the intellectual arguments that you're bringing.
Yes, in the sense that I think most people in our community, whether they're a university graduate or kind of just doing your average job in your average community, still has all of the same questions. Can I believe the Bible? You know, why would God allow suffering? Even you don't need a degree to have those questions. But the trouble is, we answer them as if you've got a PhD, you know, of 25 minutes of uninterrupted verbiage. And most people are gone in the first 30 seconds. So what we try to do is to say, how can we get the best minds with good material and make it easy to watch? So hence the whole mode of doing interviews. So we interviewed more than 31 people from across the globe to respond to the key blockers to faith.
And in that sense, you didn't shy away from going to the intellectual heavyweights. You feature lots of people, you know, from the Oxford scene, all over the world, really. But is it the way that it's packaged, the way that it's brought to the viewer, that makes the difference?
Yes, in the sense, Justin, that we haven't shied away, as you say, from heavyweights in the intellectual world, from Richard Swinburne to John Lennox and John Polkinghorne, all from the UK. But what we've done is that you only watch everybody's, it's beautifully edited, so you only watch 2 minutes of somebody and then you swap to another person, then you swap to another person. You don't get a lot of me as the host. It tends to be a little seamless. Now, I'm sure that people listening to me now will think, that sounds like a mess, but it actually works because it's brilliantly edited. So it's actually quite easy to watch in the sense that you get good material, but because you keep changing people on the same kind of theoretical line, it does flow. It's easy to watch, but it still gives you good material.
How did you decide on the key questions that you wanted to answer?
Well, we did research because we had a think tank about this whole idea, and a few people in the think tank said, you know, Carl, there's a lot of commentary about what blocks people from faith, but not a lot of data. So we actually did a reasonable sized, for the funds and resources we had, survey across Australia to go, so what blocks you from Christian faith? And we came up with the 10 top blockers to faith. Now, we didn't do it exactly on the 10 top blockers. We collapsed a couple together and we moved it around a little bit, but it did give us a bit of a picture as to what blocks people from faith.
Okay, give us a sense then of the kind of questions that you're attempting to answer.
Well, you know, there's the classics that are still there. You know, why does God allow suffering? And we've just surveyed people who have seen the show, and that still comes up as the key question. And you know, religious violence or exclusive faith is just one way to God and the Bible. So they're all there, and most people would expect to see them there. But the three that one of the things that the 10 top blockers demonstrated to us is that of the 10, five of them were the church. And when you do apologetics today, I think today in today's environment, you can't not go to some of those issues. And three questions we deal with in the series, which are fairly unique for any series of this nature around the world, is we actually have a episode on homosexuality and the church's response to homosexuality. We have an episode on church abuse, because that's massive around the world, and certainly in Australia right now it's huge. You know, the whole idea, well, you know, why don't you stand for the morals you claim? You know, it undermines our whole position. And the third is, and this is a very Western issue, it's certainly not an issue in places like Asia and, say, in places like some parts of Africa, but certainly in the West, in Western countries, it's, well, isn't the church just obsolete? I mean, you know, with the last old person leaving the building, please turn the lights off. You know, that idea, and that's a very pervasive idea. Like, why would I join something that's dying? And yet it's not. I mean, and it's a pretty, that's a pretty simple episode, Justin. We just go around the world and show there's just outstanding things happening. But that's not the perception. So and what we also did was we actually asked every person that we interviewed, so how did you come to faith? Or somebody very close to you? And the last episode is actually called Towards Belief, which is kind of a gospel one in the sense that it just has people saying how they came to faith. And there's a myriad of reasons which kind of go through a whole bunch of different areas. So those are what some of the reasons that this is quite a unique series.
Sure. Well, I mean, what's the target audience? Is it for skeptics or is it more for Christians who want to engage with their skeptic friends?
Look, you'd be really surprised to hear me say it's both. one of the things that we did aim at, though, in the research, we actually put a filter across it. 51% of Australians said they were open to faith, 49% said they weren't. Actually, it's the other way around. But what we did was we asked what blocks those who are open. Because if you're an out-and-out skeptic, other than the kind of miraculous work of the Holy Spirit, no series is really going to make a difference. You're just watching it to pick holes in it. But if you're, what we want to talk to is the person who is kind of open but has genuine questions, and we want to go, okay, we've got some responses. The second thing, though, for us is, one of the things that I think in our community and in Western nations that Christians have kind of moved into fearful silence. Like, I'm not going to put my head up because this is just too scary.
Sure.
And what we want is to get people into positive engagement. You stand on solid ground. There's plenty to demonstrate the veracity of what we're talking about.
Restoring confidence in that sense.
Yeah, that's true. And also, one of the wonderful things about the series is because you get little grabs, you get lots of little grabs from lots of people, and they're very memorable grabs, Justin. Mm, so you can kind of, somebody asks you a question, you go, okay, I remember Amy Yor Ewing said this about that question. And you just regurgitate her, which is great. But because they're kind of nice, short pieces, they're not hard to remember.
It's helpful to have a soundbite sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, the other thing too is we people across this country are showing it in their churches, in their small groups, in local clubs and pubs. So it's, you know, places where they're getting some confidence, but there are other places where they're engaging with their open but unbelieving friends to create discussion.
Yeah, good stuff. I mean, obviously, as you say, it started out, your idea, you're an Australian, and it's primarily come from the Australian angle. But why should us Brits get hold of your Australian DVD about apologetics?
Yeah, well, in this, we just haven't mentioned the Ashes, so that's probably a good thing. The key in this, Justin, is that while we filmed it, Olive Tree Media is an Australian group, we filmed it internationally. So I think 11 of the guests are Australian. Of the other 20 guests, they're either American or they're from the UK. And so it has a very international feel. In fact, if people go on and want to watch the trailer at towardsbelief.org.au, it looks very British. Mm. And the play-on is actually at Oriel College in Oxford. And lots of the guests are British guests. So we designed this as an international series. So we filmed it across America. We filmed it in the UK and a number of people from Australia. So it has a very international feel about it. And Authentic Media in the UK are distributing in the UK, and with them we're doing a launch in the UK. So as I said, the trailer actually feels very British, and you don't see a lot of me as the host, and you see a lot of great UK guests. So that's a great endorsement, isn't it?
Well, look, I'm excited about it, and I've obviously been able to watch quite a bit of it, and it really is fantastically produced, as you say. And I'm excited to hear more about it and how it's being used in the UK as you commence the launch. If people want to find out more right now, how should they do that, Carl?
Well, to find out more about Towards Belief itself is to go to towardsbelief.org.au, towardsbelief.org.au. Now, that website, there'll be there's you can watch a trailer. There's links to show you all of the like the background to the episodes, who's on them, who are the guests, all of that. And on that, we'll also have the details on that website of the launch. And the launch will be at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity, at the Institute where, which is in Verve Street, isn't it? Is that right?
Yes, I think so. LICC, as it's known by its acronym. But that's happening this coming week. So great stuff. Looking forward to seeing you hopefully in the UK as well at some point, Carl. But for the moment, thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing with us about Towards Belief.
Thanks, Justin. Great to be with you.
Well, thanks for all those who've been getting in touch in the past week. And as ever, if you want to get in touch about any topic you heard on today's show, be interested to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, @UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you'd like to follow the Facebook page. And there's some recent articles that I've posted up there as well from Premier Christianity magazine. I was able to interview recently Vicky Beeching, a well-known former worship leader, now something of a media commentator, really. She's been vocal in her support of same-sex marriage in the last year or so. And over the summer, she actually came out herself as gay. Well, I've got an interview with her in the latest edition of the magazine. You can read it at Premier
DearChristianity.com and see what she had to say. She said that talking to us was like talking to family, because obviously she comes from the evangelical wing of the church herself and says she still loves it, but she wants to see a dialogue open up here. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that profile interview with her that's available now at PremierChristianity.com. Thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch. And as I say, we will be reading some of your emails in just a moment's time. People also leaving feedback now on the show page where you can comment under the various shows. And we'll be hearing some of that as well. A quick shout out for Reboot. This is the apologetics conference for young people and teenagers. It's a fantastic event. They had their first one last year and they've got their second one coming up in a week's time. So that's on Saturday, the 27th of September. It's in London and they're expecting really a capacity crowd. It's grown a lot this year, the Reboot Conference, and it's put on by the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. Great speakers, very accessible for young people. So if you'd be interested in attending, do check that out, or you're taking a group of young people or whatever. This really is your last chance to go along, I think, so I can recommend it. And if you're not too late, why not see if there are tickets still left by searching for Reboot Apologetics, that kind of thing, online. Ruth Jackson, lovely person who was featured, of course, at this year's Unbelievable, the conference, talking about reaching young people. She is behind it. She's doing some of the advertising around it. Okay, let's look at your feedback. And last week we aired a show on Atheists, The Origin of the Species. That's the new book by Nick Spencer. He was in conversation with atheist philosopher Julian Bajuni. Well, Tim Holton said, absolutely fantastic show. All your normal commenters and trolls should be forced to listen to this show and pass a brief test before being allowed to comment, except me, obviously. That way we can cut at least 50% of the noise from religious nutters and scientistic atheists in one fell swoop. You're on a roll, Justin, with this and Graham Ward in consecutive weeks. Love it. Thank you very much for getting in touch, Tim. Kirk Watson, who also commented via Facebook, says, I enjoyed the show. However, it's worth mentioning that the early socialist Robert Owen was no atheist, at least not in any of his books that I've read. And he was mentioned, of course, by Nick Spencer as sort of being a somewhat undercover atheist who was a philanthropist as well. Well, you say, as far as you're aware, that's not the case. Rather that simply his God was an unorthodox one. Also, in Mr. Spencer's book cover, which is also the episode banner, the first two individuals in the evolutionary lineup, Hobbes and Voltaire, are only atheists in popular imagination and caricature. Hobbes' God was heterodox, but he was a theist. Voltaire was the furthest thing from an atheist. He consistently attacked atheism and ridiculed atheists in his books. This isn't nitpicking. There's no point discussing the history of atheism unless we start with accurate data. That said, love the show. Have been tuning in every week for 2 years now. Thank you, Kirk. Well, I don't think that banner, that picture, which is quite a good one, actually, sort of showing that sort of typical Darwinian evolutionary sort of image of the ape to the man, but showing different atheists. I'm not sure it actually was meant to sort of represent just atheists, because I think Charles Darwin is also one of the figures on it. And of course, as Nick pointed out last week, he was not an atheist either. I think it's more probably included because of their influence on the movement overall. But thank you for getting in touch. Good response to that show of last week. Let's go back to the show of the week before. Just time for a couple of emails on that. That was Graham Ward, Regius Professor of Divinity, talking about the biology and psychology of believing. His new book is called Unbelievable. James Hill writes, it's not very often that I eye roll at your excellent show, but when Graham Ward began positing that the attractiveness of atheist literature is solely based on the prose and that beneath it all is some anger, well, I had to pull over for fear I would crash my car. It's one thing not to agree with atheists, it's another to assume that they'll only arrive at their position due to anger issues. This assumes that theism is a natural conclusion for which there is no valid rational opposition. As an atheist raised without religion, I have no anger or other emotional cues to my atheism. I simply don't find the God claim compelling or credible. As an American, I do get angry at the illegal legislation of religious beliefs, but that's not fueling my stance on the existence of God. I'm getting angry again just typing this. Overall, great show, and I think you did a superb job acting as the atheist advocate in the previous week. Okay, thank you. And this is Clay in Frankfort, Kentucky. Says, thank you for having Graham Ward and Sue Blackmore on your show. I found it interesting to hear about Sue Blackmore's out-of-body experience and her transition into a materialist viewpoint. Well, Clay, if you go further back in the archives for Unbelievable, you'll find a more lengthy show with Sue in which she talks about that. You say, it does strike me as very ironic that she should go through something so amazing and then land in the materialist camp. I find that there's a lot of work ahead for both materialist and immaterialist viewpoints of understanding belief in a person's mind. At this time, the Christian view of the soul remains defendable enough for me. I don't know that the view can be easily articulated for everyone who likes the subject matter, but it is defendable to a large extent. Thank you very much, Clay. Thanks to all those who have been in touch with their thoughts. And thank you for listening to today's programme. And don't forget, we always enjoy hearing from you. So I look forward to hearing your responses on this issue of abortion, and we'll see what we can fit in next week at the same time. For the moment, we're going to be handing over to Jonathan Vieira. He's my guest on The Profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon. But before we get to that, let me tell you what's coming up on this show next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, hundreds of years ago, Christian mathematician and philosopher Blaise Pascal made a wager. He said, you're better off believing in God because if there is an afterlife, you'll win. And if there's not, well, you've nothing to lose. Whereas if you don't believe, then you've everything to lose if it turns out to be true. Well, Kevin Moore is a young philosopher. He's updated Pascal's wager. Next week, we'll be finding out his novel approach to that as we ask, is atheism a fool's bet? Hope you can join me for that at the same time next week. For the moment, thank you for listening to Unbelievable. Do make sure to check us out online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can listen to past shows, features, get hold of the Unbelievable DVD as well there. And of course, you can find us on iTunes, podcast, and everything else besides. But until next week, have a good week, and we'll see you next time.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.